Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, best-selling author of the book, The Fitness Mindset and Rewire Your Mindset, here to help you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness and mindset. Today's guest is Dr. Stacey Sims on nutrition and training sex differences and why women are not small men. Every once in a while, I get to do a podcast with somebody who is constantly illuminating my blind spots when it comes to my research and comes to what I focus on as a coach. And I am so grateful for these conversations. And Stacey's Instagram page, Dr. Stacey Sims, is a platform that I use regularly to dive into the research on women and nutritional sex and training sex differences between men and women. And in today's podcast, we go deep on a lot of different topics. From the heading and from some of the things we're talking about, you may think this is a female-centric podcast, but I don't think so, with the exception of maybe 5 to 7 minutes in the middle where we talk about the menstrual cycle. I think men and male, particularly coaches, but anyone interested in the human physiology in general, will get massive benefit from today's episode. Some of the things we talked about, the major training and nutritional sex differences between men and women and why women are not small men. We talk about intermittent fasting in regards to how it works for men and how it works to females and how to potentially minimize the downsides for females. The biggest fitness industry misconceptions, what a natural normal menstrual cycle would look like and how the contraceptive pill can potentially affect your training goals. We also talk about the sleep and its importance on mood and recovery and the benefits of cold water immersion or things like cryotherapy and the differences for men and women. So without further ado, this is a jam-packed episode with so much information from somebody who I highly respect and follow online. And today's episode, again, covers a lot of my own blind spots where I get to ask questions based on what I want to explore. So I hope you enjoy today's episode and learn as much from it as I got from it. So without further ado, here's Dr. Stacey Sims on nutrition or training sex differences and why women are not small men. Enjoy. Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm delighted to be joined today with my guest, Dr. Stacey Sims. Dr. Stacey is an applied researcher, innovator, and entrepreneur in human performance, specifically sex differences in training, nutrition, and environmental conditions. Prior to being launched into industry, she served as an exercise physiologist and nutrition scientist at Stanford University from 2007 to 2012, then specialized in sex differences with environmental and nutritional considerations for recovery and performance, specializing in women's health and performance. With the unique opportunities Silicon Valley has to offer, during her tenure at Stanford, she had the opportunity to translate earlier research into science-based layperson's book, Roar, which we'll definitely be talking about in today's podcast. And this was written to explain sex differences in training and nutrition across the lifespan. Her contributions to the international research environment has led to her being named one of the top 50 visionaries of the running industry by DMSE Sports, one of the top 40 women changing the paradigm of her field by Outside Magazine, and one of the top 4 individuals changing the landscape in triathlon nutrition by Triathlete Magazine. And all her research publication can be found in Google Scholar. I'm looking forward to talking all things women's fitness in today's episode. Stacey, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Brian. I feel like, whoa, that is a lot of stuff. Have I done all that?
It's crazy. And I had to cut it down, Stacey, because you've done so much between the research, between the amazing content you put out online, between the book. I had to kind of narrow it down. So we'll definitely dive into more of the things that you've done as we go through the podcast. But before we do that, give us a little bit about your backstory. Tell the audience what kind of got you into your fitness field. I've touched on it there in the introduction, but explain it a little bit in your own words.
Yeah, I think it really started when I was just at university and dropped rowing for being in the crew team. It was the first time I'd ever been in a team sport, and we were training all together, men's lightweight and women's lightweight. And there were times where, like, the guys would just take off and their fitness would just accelerate so much faster than the women's. And I was kind of questioning, and it was at the same time as starting to get into exercise physiology and nutrition as an undergrad. And so I started asking those questions in class, and they're like, oh, well, you know, we don't know. Women are the same as men. We just sometimes use their data, sometimes we don't. And they were giving me really ambiguous answers, and I was just not very happy with that. So being me asking the questions why and really trying to figure out, well, what's going on, and could not find any research done on women. And when I asked why that was, they're like, well, we don't know enough about men. So we just kind of study men and throw some women in there. And if their data is a bit weird, we'll exclude it, or we don't study women because they're too difficult. And being someone who's an aspiring athlete, that just didn't sit very well. So it kind of pushed me into the whole academic path of trying to really understand what was going on with a female body as an athlete, as well as being an athlete myself, going from, you know, rowing competitively into racing Ironman in the world stage, Xterra world stage, bike racing on the world stage, and just a whole bunch of high-level athletics going along the same way as my academic path.
You mentioned there that they said women were too difficult to study. Is that due to hormone shifts and balance, or is that something completely different? What was the reason for that thinking?
The age-old excuse is because women have menstrual cycles and the hormone perturbations between phases of the menstrual cycle make it too difficult. But it's really a social construct that created that thought process. When you think about how science originated, it was really done in male medical domination, where the men were the doctors, the women were the nurses or the reception people, and women were deemed to be too delicate to be involved in research. And when you're looking at funding opportunities, they're pretty tight. Timelines are pretty tight. So people just really started excluding women, or really only looking at women in the first half of their menstrual cycle when they were more like men, or not even paying attention to what phase they were in and just rolling their data in with the men's. So people might say, oh yeah, we include women. But then when you look at the research, it's women are just included in the male data, but they haven't really dug in to say, well, what are these sex differences? How do these menstrual cycle hormones affect the outcomes that we're looking at? So people started putting it in the too hard basket, when if we were to take a vision shift and say, women should have been included at the get-go, and this is how you design a research study properly for women, it would just be a status quo. So it's combination of tight timelines and the way the social construct within research has developed, as well as people now going, yeah, well, we'll just put them all together because there aren't any real differences.
And that gives me a perfect segue, because I've quoted your line so often that women are not small men when it comes to the people that I'm working with or even in my online content. Can you explain that a little bit for us?
Yeah, so I kind of laugh about that tagline, because it used to be how we would open up a sex difference lecture at Stanford after lunch when everyone's kind of sleepy and wanted to grab the attention of the class. And I would say, well, you know, we have these sex differences in thermoregulation. And of course, that kind of opening would be yawn fest. So I'd say, so really, women are not small men. And these are the things we're going to look at. And people would sit and be like, what do you mean women aren't small men? And that would get people away. Awake and engaged in the conversation. Then when I launched a product in industry and it was women's specific hydration, that tagline became the one that went out in marketing. So I became the person that always said women are not small men. And I love it. So I'm glad it stuck.
Yeah, me too, because I think it's such a great line. I've used it so often. When it comes to the biggest sex differences, then I know this is a bit of a Pandora's box, whether you kind of come at it from training, you know, nutrition, the fasting element, ketosis, there's so many different elements. But from what you've been covering recently, Stacey, what is kind of the biggest sex differences, or what's the biggest sex difference that your audience or potentially people listening to this podcast might be unaware of that they need to consider when it comes to either training, nutrition, or, you know, whatever direction you want to take this, feel free to go with it. This is your area. But in terms of biggest sex differences, what's the one that people really need to know about?
Well, everything. So I say that kind of in jest, but when we look at all the guidelines that are out there, you know, training protocols, recovery protocols, nutrition guidelines, even the data that's coming out on some of the more trendy diets or lifestyle factors like intermittent fasting or ketogenic, it's all male data. And when we start generalizing that to women, it doesn't work. And so we have a plethora of women going, well, I don't understand why these training protocols aren't working for me. I must not be fit enough. I must be too weak for this. And they put the blame on themselves. But when we dig it out and we look and say, what are these sex differences? We know that there are identification sex differences from birth, the biological XX versus XY. So that's where I'm talking about sex differences from that biological construct. And when we look at estrogen and the epigenetic exposure within utero, that starts a cascade of sex differences. So as you get up to like puberty, that's where we see this extreme demonstration of what happens, where a little boy will get lean and fast and, you know, start to really take on those masculine qualities that we see in sport of, you know, the aggression, the speed, the power, the invincibility. But as young women go through puberty, their hips widen, their shoulder angles widen, they put on body fat and they get their period and they start to drop out of sport. So that's like the biggest point there to talk about sex differences is what do these sex hormones do? Epigenetic exposure of estrogen causes, you know, more body fat. It causes appetite differences between men and women. It causes the brain or the hypothalamus to have two areas that are sensitive to nutrient status as opposed to men who only have one. We know that things like estrogen can, when it comes up, it mutes appetite. When it's down, you get hungrier. It controls appetite hormones. When we look at training and the metabolic changes that happen with training, there are sex differences within the muscle mitochondria themselves, where there are more proteins for women to be able to use and store medium chain fatty acids. Men preferentially burn more carbohydrate than fat. So there's a whole cascade of things that happen because of the epigenetic exposure of sex hormones, both in men and women. And when you take it out of that, you know, the medical and the physiological and start to put it in the fitness industry, people backlash because they're like, wait, this isn't what I learned. This isn't how I operate, because it becomes too big of a concept. We're slowly making inroads, like with menstrual cycle tracking and being able to identify patterns within the menstrual cycle, or if someone's using an oral contraceptive pill and really understanding what that OC is doing. We're getting better inroads, but there's still a really long way to go with regards to what are the proper methodologies to change women. I just read this study today talking about high intensity interval training and should there be different protocols between men and women. It comes out that yes, there should be, that women are really well suited for that top end short sprint interval training, where men are better at the longer HIIT type training. And again, that comes down to the way that women's bodies can handle high intensity, where they have a very short ability to regenerate the ATP from the PCR cycle, because we often have lower amount of creatine. We have differences across the menstrual cycle of creatine kinase activation. So when we're looking at that short, sharp stuff, being able to get adaptations at a top end is more of a metabolic challenge to women than it is to men. So all these little minutiae things that we look at and we find in the physiological aspects and then try to push it out into the big world of the fitness industry, it's been very interesting.
Yeah, there's definitely two topics I'm going to double back on. The contraceptive conundrum, I know you've talked about this, about the contraceptive pill potentially blunting training goals, and definitely fitness industry misconceptions that you see. But you've talked about intermittent fasting there in the nutritional guidelines. I definitely want to explore this with you, because I've learned a lot through the research that you've linked and put up, because this was a definite blind spot for me as a nutritionist and as a coach when I'd be working with my females who were into intermittent fasting or who were doing that as a protocol before they came to me. And I hadn't fully considered that it's going to work completely different for females than it does for males. Can you expand a little bit on intermittent fasting in particular and its effect on females? And you can take that in whatever direction you like, but just, I think it's important for the audience to know that, again, to go back to your tagline, women are not small men, but can you speak to that in regards to intermittent fasting?
Yeah. So when I talk about intermittent fasting, it could be anything from the time restricted eating to doing a full day of fasted and then a full day of eating. So I'm talking specifically about nutrient status within men and women. When we look at what happens in the brain when we have low calorie intake, there are two areas in the brain for women, specifically in the hypothalamus, that this neuropeptide kisspeptin affects. So they affect these two areas of neurons in the brain. When there is low amount of nutrient status, meaning low calorie, particularly low glucose, blood glucose, low carbohydrate intake, these neurons are downregulated. So what's really important to understand about these kisspeptin neurons is they are essential for reproductive status. They're essential for thyroid function. So when you get this downturn of kisspeptin, then you also start to turn off luteinizing hormone, and you also start to downregulate thyroid. So when we see after 4 days of low energy availability, which happens a lot with intermittent fasting, thyroid is starting to come down, resting metabolic rate is coming down, and the threshold for women to like stay out of this kind of low energy state is around 45 calories per kilogram of body weight. When we look at men, on the other hand, men have one area in the hypothalamus that is affected by the kisspeptin and one area of neurons. So the threshold for sensitivity of this nutrient status is different between men and women. So this is where you see where men do fantastic on intermittent fasting, fasted training, because the threshold for downturning the endocrine system is so much less sensitive in men than it is in women. So we know that for low energy status, women are that 45 calories per kilogram, but men sit around, you know, 15 to 20 before we start seeing a lot of disruption. That's a huge difference. So when we start talking about intermittent fasting, what happens is a lot of women will then go into their training in the fasted window, and they're thinking they're expanding the fast. But what they're doing is they're increasing the conversation within the brain to say, wait, there's not enough nutrient to actually support basic health as well as the stress of exercise. So then it really is a strong stress on the woman to have these metabolic shifts and these signalings to change, to start downturning metabolic rate, to start storing abdominal fat, to start burning more muscle because you're in a great catabolic state. So when we are specifically talking about intermittent fasting, and we read the research about how intermittent fasting is so great for longevity, again, it's either on overweight men, overweight women, men who are recreationally active, but there's never been inclusion of recreationally or elite athletic women. When they start doing that, you start seeing these differences where you don't hear about it in the media because it's not what the popular media is promoting, either in the medical or in the fitness world of intermittent fasting is so great for us.
And I know there's a lot of people listening here who follow that intermittent fasting protocol potentially just because, again, it's one of those fitness industry trends that's been trending for the last several years and kind of hasn't died down yet. But for females who are listening to this, Stacey, who want to minimize the downsides, they're not willing to give up intermittent fasting for whatever reason, their choice or schedule-wise or lifestyle-wise that suits, or potentially for the health reasons that they have associated potentially with it or that they think that they've associated with it. How would you minimize, or what would you recommend to potentially minimize the downsides? Would you recommend some form of micro-fasting where they're consuming something and not extending the window? Or would you offer advice in any other way that they could potentially minimize those downsides to intermittent fasting based on what you've said?
Yeah, it's really simple. It's called eating normally. And it's really hard for people to grasp that concept because we're now at an age where calories are available all the time everywhere. But if you were to get up, you eat breakfast and then you do your training, or you have a snack, you do your training, you go through the day, you have, you know, your meals throughout the day, and then you stop eating after dinner. So, you know, you're not eating 7, 8 p.m. after that, and you sleep, and that's a fast. That is intermittent fasting, where you have a block of around 12 hours where you're not having food come in, and this is where your body does all its reparation. When women are really glued to the, you know, 20-hour fast, 4-hour eating window, or I've got to do my fasted training, this is where we really start seeing the complications. One of the most recent studies that came out 3 weeks ago, and it lit up Twitter like no tomorrow, where there was a study done on regular or normal weight individuals, lean individuals who were then intermittent fasting. And they were, you know, following the general protocol, putting exercise in, and they ended up with almost sarcopenia after 6 months. And the reason for that is the first thing that gets used when you are in a calorie deficit and trying to exercise is lean mass. Breakdown state. So if you're trying to preserve lean mass and build lean mass, like intermittent fasting and fasted training end up being the worst thing that you could do, both as a man and a woman, if you are normal weight or already lean. If you're obese or overweight, different story. That's a different population. There can be a time and a place for it. But for people in general who are healthy weight, trying to improve their fitness, build their lean mass, it's counterintuitive as a physiologist to really say, why are you going to try to build mass in a time when you're not in abundance? Because in order to get a signal to put lean mass on and to keep it, your body has to be in a period of abundance. And what I mean by that is in a nutrient status where it's like, yeah, okay, there is enough stuff coming in where I can build tissue.
Would that only be applicable in a caloric deficit? So if somebody went into a surplus or was even eating maintenance outside of the intermittent fasting, would that still apply?
Well, sort of, but not really, because there's some stuff that looks at where you put calories as well. So some studies out of Scandinavia looking at within day calorie restriction or within day calorie availability. And if you book in your calories on either end of the day, but you are not paying attention to food in and around training, you end up in this catabolic state for an extended period of time. And this is where your kisspeptin gets downturned and you start getting all these signalings to conserve, conserve, conserve. So even if you eat enough to support what you're doing, but it's at the wrong time, you can still get these perturbations within the endocrine system that causes a cascade effect of downturn metabolic rate, losing lean mass, putting on belly fat. Again, the threshold is different between men and women, but it still happens in both sexes.
I know how much you stay on top of the research, Stacey, and you mentioned there last week how Twitter blew up, because that's what happens with Twitter anytime anything comes out. But in terms of the misconceptions that are in the fitness industry, is there any particular one that you think is, or not, I won't say destructive for people, because that probably isn't the right language to use, but one that people are grossly misinformed on that you see regularly when it comes to potentially social media, because of, you know, Twitter, Instagram, and just the ability for everybody to have an opinion, and, you know, nutrition being a science, not an opinion. Is there anything that you see regularly that particularly irks you online in terms of misinformation, or something that's just completely untrue, for the lack of a better term, when it comes to what's being promoted on social media?
Yeah, I mean, I talk so much about the ketogenic and the intermittent fasting and the fasted training, because those are the things that really irk me when I know how disempowering it is for women. You might find that women have success on these for 3-4 months, and then they start going, wait, what's going on? This isn't working for me anymore. And it just plays into the negative talk that so many women already play into because of the way that we've all grown up and the way that society makes us feel. And so when you start looking at what's out there on social media and pushing these diets and these lifestyles, as some people call them, it's such a disservice to women. And I get so irate, and I just have to sit on my hands sometimes and not mouth out about it, because I'm like, okay, just let the research speak for itself. These are the links to some of the really interesting articles. And it's just one of those things. It's like, yeah, okay. And then the second thing that really gets under my skin is when people go, the menstrual cycle has no effect on performance or has no effect on training. And we know inherently that it does, but we have to tease out what is performance and what is training. And that's the conversation that isn't being had and really needs to be had, because there's a discernible difference between what you're doing for a training scope versus what you're doing one point in time for performance. So those are the two big bears that I have with the whole fitness industry and social media.
When it comes to the menstrual cycle and training in particular, what's a question that you wish people asked more?
What is a menstrual cycle? What's normal? Because people don't talk about it. And I'm glad to see that it is starting to have more legs and have conversation. I mean, we have some really good apps out there for tracking. But every woman's menstrual cycle is different and it does fluctuate. And I can pick out times of stress in a woman's life because her menstrual cycle will lengthen or it'll shorten. And this has to do with external stresses like traveling or something like that. And that's normal. But things that aren't normal aren't discussed either, like heavy, heavy bleeding and severe cramping that you have to stay in bed and you're like, I can't get out of bed. I can't do anything because I'm in so much pain. That's not normal. That's called meharanja, heavy bleeding. And there's help for that. And you can get help for that. You don't have to be dictated by what your cycle is doing to your body. If you understand it and learn it and know how these hormones are fluctuating, then you can be empowered by it and know how to tailor your training, know how to get help if you're having heavy bleeding. And there's so many conversations around it that still aren't being had. And that's the next thing I really want people to understand and to push. It's like you want to have a natural menstrual cycle so you can really understand what's going on with your body. Are you fueling it well? Are you adapting to training? Are you under a lot of stress? Because that's like the first thing that is a telling sign that something is amiss is changes in your menstrual cycle.
I'm going to ask a follow-up here, and this is for something that has came into my space probably a lot over the last 3 to 6 months when I'm working with my females talking about their menstrual cycle. And I have kind of always assumed, I think definitely ignorantly in terms of male coach and not discussing it, assuming that, you know, most females outside of, say, competitive athletes, high-end endurance athletes, bikini competitors would just have, quote-unquote, a normal menstrual cycle. But when I get into the discussion and into the weeds with a lot of my girls, a lot of them don't necessarily have what you would call a normal or natural menstrual cycle, and a lot of them are unaware of it. In terms of, you mentioned there are some of the signs or some of the telling signs that of what is an unnatural or non-normal menstrual cycle. What should women be looking at when it comes to a natural and normal menstrual cycle? Or what are some of the signs that they're on the right track with it?
Yeah, so a menstrual cycle is anywhere from 21 to 40 days. So if it's less than 21 days, then it's more of a sign that it's anovulatory, you're not producing progesterone. So if you have a series of cycles that are 21 days or less, then it's something to be aware of and get checked out. 40 days, not unheard of. There's so many women who have really long cycles. And what happens there is the low hormone phase extends while the body's like, okay, I'm under a lot of stress and I really need to make sure that my body can handle, you know, a baby if the egg gets fertilized. So I'm going to extend this low hormone state and beef up my immune system, increase my carbohydrate stores. So then when I ovulate, there's a better chance for this to be a successful pregnancy. So that 40-day cycle is just inherent of what's happening in today's society with everyone being so stressed out. So then that fluctuation, it can be anywhere from 4 to 5 days either side of what your normal is, whatever that is. Things that we want to look out for as well is if you miss 3 periods in a row, then that's a sign that you dove into the amenorrheic side of things where you do need to get something checked out. If you have a really short cycle and then you go back to normal, whatever your normal is, that's okay. That's a sign of an ovulatory cycle. And most women will only have 8 to 9 periods or ovulatory cycles a year. And that's normal. But a lot of people don't understand it. They think they have to have one every month and it has to be 21 or 25 days. And when things start to go a bit awry from those numbers, they're like, what's going on? So there's a lot of normalcy within the extensions of the cycles. And what we know is not normal is when all of a sudden it shortens or the bleeding pattern changes. It goes from short to long or long to short. You start to have really bad PMS symptoms that weren't there before. So this is, again, when you're tracking your cycle, you can see when there is a difference in the patterning instead of trying to do the recall.
That's such great information because I know I've had many of those conversations where the girls I've been working with, where they'll talk about, you know, I think my period's all over the place. But as you said, there's quite a long stretch in terms of what normalcy will fall under. And I think I read it was on, I can't remember, was it on the website or on your Instagram, but you were talking about having a period, meaning that you're healthy and you're adapting and resilient to stress, which I think is a really useful way to look at it and some great content that you put out around it. I'm going to pivot now in a slightly different direction, because I definitely want to touch on your book Roar, because I know how much that has helped people. It's got so much great information in there. But Stacey, from your perspective and from your vantage point, I know you spend most of your time, you're not on email, it's your team, or not on Instagram, it's your team, mostly for the DMs, etc. But in terms of what has been quoted back to you most from the book, either through social media, through Twitter, through Instagram, emails, or just in person with people, what was the biggest thing that got quoted back to you from your book Roar?
Relief. And I say that kind of like tongue in cheek, but women are like, oh my gosh, this is so true. This happens. Now I finally understand. And it's not me going crazy with, I'm not trying hard enough, or I'm not putting the work into my training. It's actually this physiological thing. Now I can understand it. So it's like this big sigh of relief where people are like, huh, I'm not crazy. I finally get the information I need to be able to make things work for me. And it becomes more of time management too, because now people don't feel like they have to spend hours and hours and hours in the gym training on days where they don't feel well. So yeah, that's the one word. It's relief.
And as somebody that has written several books as well, I'm curious, you definitely have a section in there, because I think every author I've ever spoken to has a section in there that you wish people narrowed in more on that they don't for whatever reason. What chapter or section jumps to mind when I say that?
Really about the menstrual cycle, understanding what the hormones do. They're not just reproductive hormones. Estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone affect every cell in the body. So like when estrogen crosses the blood-brain barrier, it increases the density of serotonin receptors and increases serotonin itself. So women will start to feel very anxious and they can't sleep and like, what's going on? If you were to take some branched chain amino acids and increase the amount of leucine that's circulating, the leucine is preferred to use the same protein transport as tryptophan. And we know that tryptophan becomes serotonin. But if leucine's there, leucine's preferred, it gets in there, serotonin gets downplayed, and the anxiety and depression starts to dissipate. So there's a lot of that kind of stuff in and around the menstrual cycle. When you start to understand what these hormones do, then you can start to see what's happening in your life. And like, I'm not crazy. It's not the work stress. It's around ovulation, or it just really empowers in all levels. I mean, there are women's leadership in business that are saying, okay, we should start looking at how we are leading our companies around our menstrual cycle too, because there are days where we're more acute or astute and we can make better decisions. And then there are some days where we need a little bit more time to mull on things. And so again, it's not just training and nutrition about the menstrual cycle. It's across the board.
I know you've spoken about how women need more amino acids circulating. You mentioned branched chain amino acids there, the benefits of tryptophan, etc., with different amino acids. Is that a day-to-day basis, or is that based on the time of the month that women should be considering that?
I think what needs to come out in nutrition guidelines is women need more protein than what is being prescribed for the most part out there. And with age as well, because women don't age linearly like men. Like there's a discernible point where all of a sudden, boom, menopause hits and the aging factor skyrockets. And protein is really important at pre-menopause and the late 40s, once you hit menopause, and no one talks about how much you need. So in general, women need more circulating amino acids. We have to trigger mTOR from the brain, not just in the muscle. So there's all these little things. We talk about the acute use of like branched chain amino acids or a big protein hit. In the high hormone phase, it's important because progesterone is catabolic. So when progesterone comes up after ovulation, its job is to break down tissue in order to free up amino acids, to free up glucose, to free up fatty acids so that the endometrial tissue can be built soundly. So if you're not eating enough protein or don't have enough amino acids being ingested in the high hormone phase, then you're pretty much eating away more of your muscle tissue, which reduces gains for the most part.
With gains, and this is another area that, and again, one of the reasons I love your Instagram page so much is it points out a lot of my blind spots when it comes to the research I'm consuming. It's, again, you know, availability bias. That's why I'm so in tune with what you're putting up, because I know I've got a lot of areas that I need to cover and the contraceptive.
But that's good. That's good, right? Because you're learning, right?
And that's exactly why I love the page so much, because it's those blind spots. And then as soon as you dive into the research, you've got more education coming out of it. So I absolutely love that. That's definitely a positive thing. But one of the areas that you mentioned there about training gains and hormones in particular, but the contraceptive conundrum, you know, I know you talked about this, I think it was last month on your page, and how is the pill blunting your training gains? We talked earlier about empowering women. And when I think about empowering women, definitely I think contraception in general, the pill, I think it's done amazing things for that in the sense of what it's done for society and culture. But that's a completely different avenue when it comes to training and, you know, your physiology around it. Talk a little bit about how the contraceptive pill can potentially affect training gains.
Yeah. So a side story on the OC, my mentor and boss at Stanford, Dr. Stefanik, she was at Stanford when the pill was first produced, and it was the big grand thing in the feminist movement. So from that aspect, you know, we'd have these great conversations, and then I would start saying, but there's increased oxidative stress. It downregulates your natural hormones, so you can't really keep track of what's going on. And as an athlete, I'm already trying to reduce my oxidative stress. I don't want to have lots of inflammation. I don't want to have, you know, this time course where if I forget to take the pill, then I'll have breakthrough bleeding. And she's like, but it gives you control. I'm like, it doesn't really give me control. It flatlines everything. And I'm very aware of what that flatlining does to my body. As an athlete, I'm not sure I really want that flatline. So more and more research has come out about the OC. And we have different generations of the progestin component, and each generation has a different effect on the body. So knowing what generation of the progestin component you have can affect your training and your recovery. We know that the amount of estrogen that's in the pill, if it's a 10, a 20, or a 30 microgram dose, also affects things like lean mass. So if you have a 30 microgram dose, you can build lean mass, but you don't have strength in association to that build. So you can get hypertrophy, but no increase in strength. And as a physiologist who works with Olympic lifters, who is like, I put mass on, but I'm not any stronger, that's a decline in performance. It's not a positive aspect. So when we look at all the things across the board that the OC does from a health standpoint, yeah, it's great. It gives women the ability to control when they're going to have their bleed, if they're going to have a bleed, if they suffer from endometriosis or they have Meharangia, you can use the pill to control that. But from an athletic standpoint, you leave so much performance potential on the table when you're taking a combined oral contraceptive pill. One, those hormones are, you know, 6 to 10 times more potent to every cell of the body just because of the molecules that you're taking in. They downregulate your natural hormones. So you don't have the checks and balances to see if you're training too hard or if you're adapting or not. I've already talked about the increased oxidative stress. And so that inhibits adaptations. We also know from those who follow heart rate variability as a recovery metric that there's about 2 days at the onset of taking the pill and about 3 or 4 days in the sugar pill week where you actually are recovered. The rest of the time you have more and more delayed recovery. And in order to get the same training stimulus as someone who's not on the pill, you have to look at doing 3 days to their 2 days. So there is definitely an impact on recovery and adaptation.
Yeah, I had a very interesting conversation recently on the podcast with a herbalist and naturopath on the contraceptive pill. And, you know, she took it in her teens for endometriosis and how it largely masked a lot of that. And then she had to deal with the problems when she came off it later in life. Mm-hmm. And she said that was the thing she wished she had known, you know, in her teens or in her early 20s. Stacey, when it comes to, you're so on top of the research, you put out amazing content between the book, between what you put on social media. You know, I know there's lots of stuff between the courses and everything that you're putting out for your audience and people who are following you. But if you could go back to, say, your earlier mid-20s, what's something that you wish you knew then that you know now?
Oh, yeah. I wish I knew that intensity and lifting with protein would make me a much more resilient, faster, stronger endurance athlete. Because when I was in my 20s, I was like, I ran 20 marathons before I was 20. I was on the crew team. I did some ultra running. I got involved in cycling. So I was doing heavy endurance training. And yet I still was like having stress fractures. My body composition wasn't optimal. And there's all these things that I just wish I could go back and be like, look, you're training way too much. You need to back it down. You need to get your periods straight. You need to eat more, especially around your training, and do some high intensity stuff. And then that would have, it would have set me up for a lot of things that I wish I'd been set up for.
Yeah, and hopefully there'll be a lot of people who are listening who will learn from the mistakes. You know, I'm a big fan of, you know, smart people learn from the mistakes, really sharp people learn from the mistakes of others. And I'm constantly trying to do that myself. So hopefully that will do it for a lot of people listening. In terms fast forwarding then to more recent years, Stacey, what's something that you've changed your mind about in recent years, either from new research or from just a paradigm shift based on whatever it is that you've been working on? Is there anything that jumps to mind in the last 3, 4, 5 years that you've change your mind about?
Yeah, so still, you know, long-term endurance athlete trying to rehab from being an endurance athlete and putting in heavy lifting and putting in interval training and learning to love it. And when we look at the research and talk about interval training, we're not talking about the moderate intensity, like you can hold it for 3 to 5 minutes. We're talking about top end, gonna vomit kind of stuff. So I've really started implementing heavy lifting and that top end stuff. So really shortening the amount of time I'm training and being able to do that high intensity stuff. And it just changes everything. It's like I'm stronger as a cyclist, I'm stronger as a runner, but I don't have to do as much training. And so I wish that people who are coming up in age as well also know the benefit of that high intensity and lifting and not spending the hours and hours training, because that's where things go wrong. Spending so much time in that modern intensity stuff doesn't do very many people any good.
And you mentioned recovery there, which gives me a very nice transition into something you've covered recently about sleep, and that how without good sleep, you'll always struggle to reap the benefits from your training and your recovery will always be compromised. Can you expand or explore a little bit the benefits or what people need to focus on when it comes to sleep?
Yeah, we still don't really know why we need to sleep. We just know that we do. And the reason that we found for sleep is it solidifies memories, and it's also the time where our body does deep reparation. It's a time where we're not consciously aware and stressed from our external surroundings. So the body focuses internally to really repair everything. So when we look at what's happening in our sleep deprived or interrupted sleep states, we are offsetting our circadian rhythm. We are losing the ability to activate our parasympathetic responses. We definitely are losing the ability for metabolic control and for full adaptation to the stress that we put our bodies under. So people are like, oh, I can live on 4 hours of sleep. I'm like, not really. So when we look at what's happening with the REM sleep, the slow wave sleep, and how much an adult needs just to be able to function well as a human, let alone when you start putting training on top of that, it becomes paramount that people really take sleep into consideration the same as they go for a hard session in the gym. Because without adequate sleep, going to the gym is a moot point. And we know that people will get up at 4:30, try to hit the gym before work, and they're compromising their sleep, and then it causes this cascade effect. And it's like, you know, if you're really tired and you can't get up to that alarm, listen, just sleep in, get more sleep, get quality sleep. And then there's all the sleep hygiene that goes around it, like using blue light filters, sleeping in a cool room, not having your phone or screens with you in your room. So minimizing all those disturbances so that your body can get into that deep parasympathetic response that allows you to get into that deep sleep.
Yeah, and I think I definitely misunderstood sleep for a long period. For a long time, I was kind of nutrition first, training next, and sleep was third. Whereas now I actually think it's right up there with nutrition in terms of particularly when it comes to recovery. And a thing I say to people that it's a bit of a common sense question that I get people to consider, that when somebody's training for something like an ultra endurance event, you know, I'll do ultra marathons, I'll do triathlon, your calorie requirements go up. I'm like, that makes a lot of sense to people. I'm like, well, you're burning more calories, you're going to need more food, more calories, more recovery from the food that you're eating. And people don't apply that to sleep, that they'll think, well, yeah, I need 6 hours. I'm like, well, if you're training for multiple hours, your sleep requirements go up. They don't stay steady. And I think it's important for people to understand that. Do you find that people fail to, or either don't regard that or disregard it when it comes to, well, I need 6 hours of sleep or 7 hours of sleep, and they don't adjust that based on the time of the month for potentially for a menstrual cycle or their training, and they don't factor that in? Do you see that regularly with people, Stacey?
All the time. And one of the biggest things that happens when someone comes to see me and says they're, you know, they're tired and they're not adapting and they're exhausted and they're trying to eat, so I look at how much sleep they're getting, and they're getting that, you know, 5 to 6 hours, but one, it's not quality sleep, and two, it kind of falls in the wake up time around 4 o'clock, where people are like, oh yeah, I feel like I've got enough sleep. And then they get up and they do training and work and all the stress that comes with it. But then they don't go, well, I better go to bed at 8. They're like, oh, I'll stay up till 11. And it's just that short sleep. And once you start increasing the amount of sleep, everything falls into place.
Do you think there's any other, on top of sleep, obviously, and we touched on nutrition, and just kind of more personally, either that you've applied yourself or with people that you've worked with, or, you know, through the different research that you've seen, is there any other underused element of recovery? For example, you know, I'm a big fan of cryo baths, ice baths, for, you know, just to improve my recovery between sessions if I'm doing a lot or heavy training load, more so for the endurance stuff than, you know, hypertrophy, obviously, as opposed to blunting what you need for repair. But is there any underused or particular recovery methods that you quite like that fall outside of sleep or nutrition?
Yeah, so women should really look at using cold water immersion post-exercise, because this is, again, where sex differences fall into play. When you start looking at, like, cryotherapy, cold water immersion, they're like, the evidence isn't really there. And it's because, again, the evidence comes from men. But when you look at what happens post-exercise, women vasodilate, so all their blood goes to their periphery. Men vasoconstrict, so the blood goes centrally, which is really fantastic for that acute recovery. But women, if they get rid of that vasoconstriction by cold water immersion or even cool shower within 30 minutes of finishing their exercise session, they also vasoconstrict and send more blood to this, to the heart, and then they can facilitate recovery a lot faster. So that cold water immersion is super important for women, especially after hard training sessions. And then the other underestimated thing is parasympathetic activation. Like in the yogi set, you're talking about mindfulness, but in reality, it's like taking that time and that step away for 5 or 10 minutes to be able to focus on your breath or focus on the way that a breeze feels against your face. So you can just focus on that one thing and really start to activate that parasympathetic response, because so many women stay in a sympathetic drive where they're in that flight or fight for so long, and that becomes their new normal. And then they can't get into a good sleep. Them, they're more anxious, they're more prone to mood disorders, they're more prone to PMS. And so when we learn to activate that parasympathetic response, then again, it feeds forward in better sleep quality, better mood control, less PMS, better stress resilience, and better immunity.
I love that. That positive feedback loop, I think, is so valuable for people to consider, that when you get that right, it has a knock-on effect for everything else and makes, you know, the recovery aspect, the PMS aspect, the hormonal aspect so much more either tolerable or better, you know, for the lack of a better term. So I think that's so valuable for people, Stacey. I've loved this conversation, Stacey. I have only one more question for you, because I know you're doing a million and one things at the minute, between the research, between the courses. I've seen a lot of people with the graduate certs on your Instagram stories. But I'm curious, what are you most excited about right now?
Oh, gosh, that's so many things. We are doing a bunch of mini courses, which I get excited about because it's just a short, sharp bit of information, and I can really get in deep in the research and then disseminate it. So things like creatine. Most women are like, I don't want to use creatine. It makes me gain gain water weight. It's not that effective. It's like, no, every woman should be using creatine. It doesn't cause water weight gain unless you're loading it like men do. So yeah, there's lots of little tidbits of information that are good for both men and women to learn from. So I like doing the short, sharp mini courses. Gives people, you know, the time to invest maybe 30 or 45 minutes and learn something new without taking on a full 7 to 8 week course of 72 hours worth of stuff.
And are they available through the website?
They will be. We are making them available to the membership first, and then we'll release them as they come out.
Amazing. And I will link the website in the show notes for people. Stacey, I've loved this conversation. As I said, I'm a big fan of the content you put up online. It's constantly making me challenge some of my own blind spots. So I'm so grateful for that as a coach on my side. Stacey, for people listening, where is the best place for them to follow you? Is it on Instagram? Is it on Twitter? Where would you like to send people now? And I will link all of those in the show notes for today's podcast.
Facebook and Instagram for more of the posts that you're aware of. And then Twitter is more my research account where I talk about different research topics that have come out or some of our more recent research that's been published. So yeah, it depends on what flavor you want.
Yeah, so I recommend, just to knowing my audience here, for those that are listening who regularly consume the podcast, definitely Facebook and Instagram. It's very digestible for the layperson. But I know my sister is a big fan of your Twitter account and she's a research lecturer as well. So for those in that space, definitely the Twitter, but go follow you on everything. I think if you're unsure, that's the way to go. And I will link those in the show notes for today's episode. Stacey, thank you so much for all the value you put out there. Thank you for constantly putting out the research and, you know, breaking down a lot of the misconceptions for people online in terms of how they need to view their body and the sex differences between men and women. I think that's so valuable. And thank you so much even more for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, well, thanks for having me and then also taking an interest in pushing it out there. So it would be useless for me to sit in my own little green room and talk to myself. So without people like you, it would just stay in my brain. So thank you.
My pleasure. So there you have it, Dr. Stacey Sims on nutrition or training sex differences and why women are not small men. I loved this episode. I got so much from it myself. I'm definitely going to be saving this on my podcast app and going back over it a couple of more times just to pick up some of the value and some of the things that I missed the first or second time around. So I hope you enjoyed and learned as much from this episode as I did. As always, if you did, be sure to take a screenshot, pop it up on your Instagram stories. You can tag myself and Stacey, Brian_Keen_Fitness, or Stacey Sims and Stacey Sims on Instagram. And if you want to get my takeaways, where I do my 3 email takeaway every single week from the podcast based on what I've learned from the episode, be sure to subscribe to my newsletter. Just head over to BrianKeenFitness.com, and on the homepage, you can pop in your email and you will get my newsletter every Thursday breaking down my top 3 takeaways from that week's episode. This week's will be with Dr. Stacey Sims, where I'm breaking down some of the things I learned in today's episode. So that's everything from this week. Thank you for listening. Catch you next Monday.